This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 29th of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Culture is brought to you in association with Parsol. Hello and welcome to the 155th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today we're dotting the I's and crossing the T's. We're learning about handwriting in all its forms, from the technical to the anthropological to the spiritual. Why not have us round to dip our quill in your ink bottle? You'll be relieved to learn that there is plenty of lead in our pencil. Here's what I've written by hand by way of a menu. We'll speak to the chair of the National Handwriting Association, they of keeping up standards.
Handwriting has a real contribution to make, which we've found growing evidence to support handwriting as conferring a benefit which other technologies can't match.
We'll speak to novelist and pal of the show, Alex Preston, about why he wrote his latest book, Longhand.
For me, this was about glorifying the act of writing. It was about making it a kind of practice. There was something really magical about it.
And we'll speak to a leading graphologist who'll frighten me a little by analysing my handwriting and therefore my soul.
You give yourself quite a lot of obstacles in your life. I think you're impatient. I don't think you'd suffer fools gladly at all. And very versatile, very quick thinker, I would say.
Plus, we'll go to Salt Lake City to report from the depot where America's illegible letters are deciphered. Producer Holly gets her first lesson in learning to write Arabic. And we'll have a Midori House session from Sarah Jane Morris, a smoky, soulful jazzer with impeccable handwriting, we're sure. That's all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Before we put pen to paper and get on with this week's theme, let's have a song. This week's session comes from Sarah Jane Morris, who burst into the public consciousness with her multi-octave powerhouse of a voice in 1986, appearing on the Communards' take on Don't Leave Me This Way, which went to number one across the world, apart from America, who obviously couldn't handle the camp. But since then, she's been avoiding pop altogether to embark on far more heady territories, making her name as a real-deal jazz and soul singer, performing highly personal and highly political songs of her own creation and collaborating with a team of similarly committed musicians and artists. From her session here at Midori House, here she is with Wildflowers.
I remember, oh my mother, in the town where I was born. I remember all the squalor and wildflowers in a vault. I remember, oh, my father, in his shirt so stained and torn. I remember all the squalor, yes, wildflowers in a vase. I remember all of this as if it was just yesterday. Now remember all the reasons why I had to run away. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. I remember all my brothers in the dirty fields of corn. I remember all the fighting. Wildflowers in a vase. I remember all of this as if it was just yesterday. Now remember all the reasons why I had to run away. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. I remember, oh, my mother, as she woke me every morn, and her pure way of thinking like wildflowers in a vault. In a vault. In a vault. In a vault. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. Wherever there is my mother, there is my home. Wherever there is a mother, there is a home. I wanna go home. Yes, I wanna go home. Take me, take me, take me, take me home. Mm-hmm. Wanna go home. Yeah, I wanna go home.
That was Sarah Jane Morris with Wildflowers. More of that later. Now we're poised with our pens at the ready to begin this week's theme. Now, here's the rub. From notes to the milkman, do they still exist? To your very best Christmas card calligraphy script, handwriting is essential, individual, and perhaps a window on the soul. Graphology is the analysis of the psychological structure of the human subject through his or her handwriting, says the British Academy of Graphology. And this academy exists to help businesses pick the right staff. They'll have a look at written tests and things, help teachers help pupils in schools, and to aid the police, sometimes, in building up psychological profiles of suspects. It's interesting stuff, isn't it? Caroline Murray, the director of the British Academy of Graphology, came in and talked me through her work and then bared my very own inner workings to the listening several.
You can see most things in handwriting, but you can't see somebody's age and you can't see somebody's sex. So if somebody comes to me, I need to know what their age is and what their sex is. And you can't really see intelligence either. You can have a good guess at it, but... You know.
What are the popular misconceptions when people think, as you say, oh, you've got a very strong Y, you must have a high sex drive, or you must be this, or people with large handwriting must be confident or something.
Yeah.
Do these things ever match up?
You can't just say one thing. You know, there's 300 signs, what we call signs, and they all relate to each other. So you could have a writing that's very angular and you could say, oh, he's bossy or he's strong. But if it's backward slanting as well and the pressure on the page is light, it means something quite different. So you have to take in so many different aspects and then work it out, which takes ages, actually.
How did you get into this? Was it, are you interested in people, or was it, there must be something worth analysing in this alone?
Well, I was a pianist and I'd been studying 5 hours a day for 10 years and I shut the lid of the piano and thought, that's the end of that. I opened the Sunday Times, saw an advertisement, and I thought, my God, this is interesting. I thought I was just doing a sort of week's course, and it turned out to be a 3-year diploma course, but I couldn't leave it alone. Changed my life completely.
How does it work for you as a business?
Well, I think quite a lot of people do recruitment, you know, helping companies.
Okay.
Because, as I said, people behave quite differently sometimes, and you might have somebody who comes to you, I'm absolutely perfect for this job, I can do this, I can do that. You look at the handwriting and you see he's absolutely terrified, nervous and no good at it. And so you can save the company a lot of money and redundancy and all this kind of thing. But actually, I don't do that anymore. I'm a director, I teach it, I set exams, I research this kind of thing.
It's a fascinating subject. I mean, are you in the supermarket always peering at people's shopping list to work out whether they're an axe murderer or a porn star or whatever they might be? I mean, it must be one, it's kind of almost a bit like a superpower.
Yeah,
this kind of thing,
it is jolly interesting, but you have to be careful not to do it with your friends.
Okay, your so-called friends.
Yeah.
Presumably it's a strange thing, yeah.
The way it changed my life, it made me realise how sensitive people are, and it makes you much, much more understanding. When somebody's a bit difficult, he's a bit aggressive, and you realise it's a defence mechanism because he's bloody insecure inside, you know.
And you can get to the bottom of that with
the
handwriting.
It's so helpful. Yeah.
Before we switch the microphones on, you asked me to go away, find a blank piece of paper, write four lines on it and do a signature.
Yeah.
Write a signature. Is that all you get to work with when you're working with...
No, that's the minimum you need.
That's the minimum. So you could potentially go through people's diaries, you could go through notes of the milkman, you could find all of a collated material of someone that you were maybe the police were investigating or that needed some help or whatever it was.
But that's the minimum. What you gave me, absolutely.
Yeah.
You wouldn't just do it from a signature or a jotted note because you need to look at the spacing, the place on the page, because that's how you relate to other people. If you've got big spaces, you probably like your independence and a bit remote from others. And it's all, and the pressure on the page is all quite important.
Yeah, I remember always being told that I press far too hard in exercise books and on pieces of paper. And like,
oh gosh, you do.
I don't know what that means.
Yes.
Well, I can't help. This is going to be slightly terrifying and very interesting at the end.
Yeah.
Tell us about the reliability of graphology, Caroline, as well. This is far from a circus trick. This is used in forensics. This is used clearly in criminal investigations and all the rest of it. It forms potentially the backbone of a defence, for example, I suppose, in a court as well.
Yeah.
Tell us how reliable it is and how it is leaned upon by the police, for example.
Well, I think it's very reliable. I managed to put somebody inside for 4.5 years on a fraud thing, and it all started because there was no way of finding out about this person apart from the handwriting. And this happens quite often. I can't remember the percentage, but it's over 90% as far as I know.
It is like there is no such thing as an exact science,
no,
but it's about as exact as any of those things get.
Absolutely.
And how does it work the other way around? You see somebody's handwriting and you maybe get a picture of the person. Does it work the other way around when you meet new people? You're kind of reading through what their handwriting would be in your mind.
That.
Does it work the other way around?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Yes.
You've come on the train to London and there's a guy that won't give up his seat for you despite the fact that, you know, you've got a long train journey ahead of you, blah, 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 blah. Do you know what his handwriting will be?
Well, I could guess, yes.
Right. And what would it be like?
It would probably be heavy pressure, rather erratic in its forms, rather thick pressure, I should think, from the pen, because you know you usually choose what pen you want to write with. And it would be uncomfortable. It would be disorganised.
Well, let's have the grand reveal then.
Oh,
let's
God.
See what I'm like.
Well, you've got very big writing and it's also very trenchant on the paper. So I think that you give yourself quite a lot of obstacles in your life. You're not satisfied just with ordinary things. You're creating new ideas all the time. I think you're impatient.
Okay.
Really impatient. I don't think you'd suffer fools gladly at all. And very versatile, very quick thinker, I would say. I don't think you're full of common sense. You're not pragmatic in that way.
Right.
You're just full of ideas. And as I said, you know, lots going on, I would say.
That's absolutely fascinating. And where do you go next? I mean, with this, I mean, does this become a consultancy? You, as I say, you give talks and all the rest of it. I mean, in terms of the discovery of personality through handwriting, are new frontiers being broached
in
this field?
Well, we keep trying. I mean, we do a lot on children and adolescents and trying to, you know, the psychological aspect of it. All the time trying, doing research. I run a research group and we're trying to work out behaviour because it's quite difficult to see people's behaviour and it's quite different from their characters, actually. So, you know, how would you behave in a plane crash? You know, which ones would sit in their seats? Which ones would try and jump out? Analysing the handwriting, you can sort of work it out. So it's quite interesting.
That was Caroline Murray, Director of the British Academy of Graphology. Caroline isn't the only one making a living out of deciphering handwriting. For our next story, we're heading to Salt Lake City, home of the Postal Remote Encoding Centre. This is where incomprehensibly addressed letters go to, and awaiting them is a team of experts chewing on the ends of their pencils and deciding whether that's a 0 or a 9, Alaska or Alabama. There used to be 55 of these centres across the US, but technology has taken over, and this is now the last one standing. We sent James Nelson to meet the people who make sure badly written mail still ends up at its final destination.
Inside a massive warehouse on the outskirts of downtown Salt Lake City, the work grinds on quietly as hundreds of workers, data conversion operators, are hard at it, saving the mail, or at least keeping it moving, no matter how bad the sender's handwriting is.
It's really quiet on the workroom floor because we have a no talking policy on the workroom floor. There is a section where they can whisper, but a lot of that is so they can concentrate on what they're supposed to be doing, and that's processing the mail. So we'll have a lot of people looking at us and wondering what's going on because they don't normally hear a lot of people talking out there.
Okay.
So
should we whisper if we...
Yeah, we'll be a little quiet, but
okay.
Just wanted you to be aware when people start staring, you'll know why.
Barbara Batten is the letter whisperer, my tour guide, and the manager at the Remote Encoding Center, the last best place where hundreds of people sit in cubicles, eyes fixed on computer screens, as scanned letter and package images slide by.
You know, the Postal Service processes over 200 million images of first-class pieces of mail a day. And what the machines can't read, it sends to us here. And we process probably close to 4.5 million a day of just images that the machines say, I can't read this stuff. So it sends it to our keyers, and our keyers have to sit down and decipher whether it's a 9, whether it's a 3, whether it's a 6. You know, it's really sometimes hard to tell.
This is the old technology. This is your letter processing. When they opened us in 94, this stuff was cutting edge technology. And as you know, but because it's old technology, it takes up a lot of room.
The work here is nonstop, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. The unsung workers in the postal system trying to unscramble the scratchy, sometimes incomplete scrawled destinations. And there is a time limit to get the mail figured out and sorted, or a timeout, a shutdown of sorts, happens.
They call it a timeout. And that's where you've got a belt where you've got a lot of different slots the mail piece can go down and be sorted, and it needs to know where to sort it into.
Oh, I
so
see.
It goes around.
It has to go somewhere.
Yeah, and if it doesn't get the result within 90 seconds, if you have too much hanging on waiting for a result, then you won't accept new stuff. So you've got to get rid of...
Makes sense.
Yeah, and so we've got a lot of keyers here to be able to process it, and usually our timeouts are less than 2%. So we're really pretty good at being able to process it.
Here there are two images, so that should have been a double fed, and you rejected it. If that wasn't there, that would be a misphase because there is no postage and there is no address.
Okay.
Makes sense?
Yeah.
Training and retraining has made this facility a blue ribbon. No wonder postal representatives from other countries come to Utah to see how it's done. Group leader Tia Johnston says there will always be a need to decipher the writing.
The mail that we're getting is worse because the computers are able to read the ones with the really good handwriting. So I don't know that the handwriting is getting worse. I wondered about it because my daughter is in fourth grade, and I wondered if they were going to teach her cursive, because I'm like, you know, it's kind of a lost art. People don't really write in cursive. I myself print. I don't write in cursive. I don't know that the handwriting is getting worse. I think we're just seeing the worst part of the mail.
The people are the ones who make this place run so well. They see the worst of the mail and make the best of it. Away from the quiet zone, I meet some of them.
My name is Wendy Butterfield. I've worked here since May of 1994.
What about handwriting? And that's really why you're all here, I guess.
Oh, yeah. That's really kept us in business. Thank goodness for people not making it clear for other, you know, for computers to be able to read it. So,
okay, my name is Naomi Benedict. I've been here since March of 97. That's 17 years. My favorite handwriting story was after 12 hours of working, and I was barely thinking anymore, and I was trying to figure out what they had written, and it was Chicago, IH. And I'm just like, I don't know what state that is. So I sent it to Chicago, IH, and then eventually I remembered, oh, Chicago's in Illinois.
It seems like a challenging job, but fun. So near a bank of humming and buzzing computer terminals, I have a lesson in the art of deciphering.
So type in your zip code.
Okay, now, is that a 6?
And
it won't time out. No, it stays on your screen till you're done typing.
Okay.
Now, granted, you have to have a certain speed to pass the training, and the rate you're going, you're not going to pass.
I've failed miserably, not even close. But perhaps there's another opportunity for me here, as I'm told that during the holidays, many volunteer their time to answer letters addressed to Santa Claus or the North Pole.
So if it says Santa Claus, North Pole, Alaska, more than likely this is going up to North Pole. But there's a lot of organizations in all the mail processing.
And every now and then, an address might be readable, but just not realistic.
We've seen images here that might say to Pluto. And at that point, you know, it's really hard to get that piece of mail up to the planet, but I'm sure that we probably ended up having to reject that one. But if we can't get processed, eventually that letter will be sent to our dead letter office where, you know, it is, if it's not claimed, it will be destroyed.
Here on Earth, however, you might say the talented people in this last surviving center have seen the handwriting on the wall. They've got it figured out. Which is a relief for letter writers with a dodgy scrawl across the U.S. For Monocle in Salt Lake City, I'm James Nelson.
Thanks, James. After the break, handwriting versus computers, Alex Preston tells us about the creative process behind his latest novel, which he wrote by hand.
There's a new sound coming to Monocle 24.
This is Nick Luskin. Join me for new music from around the world, Wednesday, 1500 London time. We'll be bringing live sessions and interviews to the mix every week, and all kinds of wonderful artists and records that you might not know yet, but you're sure to love.
That's brand new music from around the world. Monocle presents Nick Luskin every Wednesday, 1500 hours London time.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where we're ploughing straight on with this week's handwriting theme, turning now to the realm of fiction. Alex Preston, you know him, author of This Bleeding City and most recently In Love and War, written by hand. I wonder why. Does it change the way a novelist writes? Does it help to get into a character, especially in a story set before the laptop and the word processor? Here is Alex Preston on handwriting.
I think, firstly, that it's a historical novel and I wanted to, in some way, mirror the way that it might have been written at the time. It's set in the 1930s. But there was also something about writing by hand that felt to me closer to a kind of craft, to a work of art, that there was something very abstract about typing this thing on a computer and it never finding its place in the physical world. And sitting there with a pen and working the paper and seeing it over the course of six or seven notebooks take shape, and being able to trace the history of the book as well. That's something that you don't get when you delete a paragraph. There's nowhere for it to go. I can see the way that the book took shape. It felt to me a much more kind of physical act, writing by hand.
And we'll get the maybe artistic side of it out the way before we start with the practical. How does it change how your mind works, what the characters do when you have to physically graft, as it were, when you're actually laying an imprint on that blank white page?
Firstly, I felt much closer to my protagonist, Esmond, that it was something I bought the pen that I wrote it with and the notebooks I wrote it in on the road where he lived in Florence. It felt like a kind of real connection to him. As you say, quite a lot of the book are letters to him or letters from him. There's a large central section of that. And so it did feel like a kind of direct connection there. I also think that there's a crucial point about writing by hand, which is the editing process is absolutely different, that you get this extra stage in writing the novel, which is when you go from the handwritten to typing it up to then send it to the editor. And that process for me was by far the richest moment of the book. I felt that I had this wonderful thing that was kind of alive there on the page, and it was taking that and feeding it into the computer and making changes at that point. It really seemed to come alive for me, the book, at that stage.
I guess it took you back to writing stories when you were a kid, writing essays for school. Like I know it would, me doing that sort of thing, writing even something for the magazine longhand in a notebook is sort of quite rare. Is that the thing? Because I think when you're younger, you write stories from beginning to end. When you're a novelist, when you're a professional writer, you kind of mess around with the format and you kind of have a good idea and you chuck it in the middle knowing you can switch it around in Word. It's harder to do in a Rhodia notebook. Did it change the way that the book kind of took shape rather than just the characters?
Yeah, it absolutely did. That I think that what it allows you is to kind of park things that you might then fit in somewhere else. Again, you don't delete things in the same way. But it was absolutely that. I mean, I'd almost forgotten how to handwrite things. And certainly the first two books I wrote solely on the computer, there was something about going, and you know, it is kind of fetishizing the act of writing, which I often encourage my students not to do. I say, you know, you have to be able to write everywhere. You have to be able to write on the tube. You have to be able to write behind your workbooks in whatever terrible job you've got. But actually, for me, this was about glorifying the act of writing. It was about making it a kind of practice. And yes, going back to that time when I would sit down and copy out a story in the back of an exercise book, and it did. There was something really magical about it.
And practically, you must have been worried, because anything can live on a memory stick, it can live on your hard drive. We know that these things are far from sort of impossible to destroy, but a single manuscript, a single thing, I mean, these things go walkabout. You know, a dropped cigarette end in the library, Alex. What about that side of it?
Yeah, I mean, strangely, having lost things on computers, I'm much more worried.
Trust the notebook more.
I trust the notebook. I kept it beside my bed and in my briefcase. I always knew where it was. But there was a sense of it would be a terminal thing. There's, you know, the story of Hemingway's wife who, you know, managed to lose all of his drafts of early work. And yeah, I was keeping the key to my office relatively close to me at all times. But, you know, again, it felt like a kind of old fashioned thing. I almost wish, and this is something I'm sort of thinking about for the next book. I was talking to my grandfather, who's a literary critic, and at the age of 90 has just delivered his 12th or 13th book, and he delivered it in person, typed up. And that's something, that's a great pleasure that we have denied ourselves in the age of the computer, that we no longer, you know, deliver our manuscripts in hand to our publishers, that we fire them off on an email. And there was something about the kind of symbolism of that journey to take the physical manuscript that I want to do. So I might even try and type up the next one.
That was novelist Alex Preston, and his book In Love and War is out now, published by Faber and Faber, and it's one of my favourite books of the year. Coming up in part two, we're going back to school. Angela Webb, who's the chair of the National Handwriting Association, tells us why handwriting is an integral part of education. Producer Holly challenges herself to a lesson in writing in Arabic. And in Delhi, we join one of the last remaining Urdu calligraphers who's trying to prevent the practice from dying out. That's all here on Culture with me, Robert Pound, on Monocle 24. But before that, let's have another song from Sarah Jane Morris. In a moment, she'll sit down for a chat with Monocle's Paul Noble. But first, here she is with Comfort They Have None.
On this stained, parched ground, in this hostile land, vile smoke in the sky, dried blood on the sand, abducted was I, 12 years and a day. Believe me, I tried to run away. Well, I was caught, dragged back there to camp. They scarred my face, on my head they left this stamp. Gave me a stick, shaped just like a gun, to help me practice for the killing runs. Well, I asked no stupid questions, heard too many lies. All I know is that our enemies must die. And all it takes, it's just one bloody day, and innocence is blown away.
Sarah Jane Morris, thank you for a wonderful session, you and your two cohorts on guitar. Let's start with the album Bloody Rain, your love for African music. This isn't something which just popped up overnight when you took a trip. This is a long-term love affair with the music of Africa.
Yes, it is. In the 80s, the first band that I was in, having left drama school, was an African Caribbean Latin band called The Republic. And then I was also in a Ghanaian band called Fufu and Light Soup. And we supported Hugh Masekela, played a lot at the 100 Club because it was run by Julian Bahula. So there was a whole fantastic South African contingency of musicians floating through. And I got involved with Artists Against Apartheid. Most weekends I was there with a megaphone outside South Africa House, so I felt very involved and found that when I started to write this album, the first song was the title track, Bloody Rain, and it was written in a hotel room in Rome with Dominic Miller. It was the beginning of something, and then I started writing with Tony Remy being my guitarist, and we found that everything we wrote had an African flavour to it, so we didn't deliberately set out to write an African-influenced album. But gradually it all fell into place. I mean, lyrically, it's about what's going on in the world around us, so it's not just pointing at Africa. But most songs, if they're not lyrically, they are melodically influenced by African music.
How did I get here? They stole my life. Why did they spare me? Made me their wife. Where is my family? Well, I have none. I'm the child of the spitting blade of the smoking gun.
Let's talk about the lyrics, because this is an album of, you know, a very passionate, intense political message here. With there's songs about politics and corruption, there's songs about FGM, there's songs about AIDS and HIV. How important is it to you that these songs find an audience, you know, who aren't put off by thinking, oh, this is political music, we're in worthy territory?
I think music is quite powerful. But I believe that the power is in subtlety. We didn't intend to make a political album. I would say I'm a social comment songwriter. What I do is try and write a human story.
Your voice is something where it can be very soft and intimate, and you can also belt it out. There's a fantastic photo of you on the album in full Janis Joplin pose. How important is it for you to look after your voice, and what sort of technique do you do, or is that not part
You're
of it?
You're asking the wrong person.
Okay.
I'm afraid I've never had music lessons in my life. For years and years, I had a huge chip on my shoulder thinking that I was inferior to everyone that I worked with because I had no training. You'd imagine that by now, I'm 55, that I would have bothered to learn to read music, but I haven't. So I have no vocal technique. I was that woman that took a child on tour everywhere and would go on stage with baby sick on my front, not even having time to put lipstick on, so forget a warm-up.
You've got a phenomenal cast on this album and in your live show.
Yes.
Just quickly run us through a few of the players.
Well, on the album, we have the Soweto Gospel Choir, we have Keziah Jones from Nigeria, we have Adam Glesser from South Africa. Yeah, I mean, musicians from all over the world.
When I close my eyes at night, I see it again, again, and again, and again, and again.
That was Sarah Jane Morris speaking to Monocle's Paul Noble. Her record, Bloody Rain, is out now. Find out more at sarahjanemorris.co.uk. This is Culture on Monocle 24, and I am Robert Bound. We're all about the written word on today's show. So far, we've been analysing, deciphering, and letting our creative juices flow onto the page through a fountain pen. But in this half of the show, we're going where handwriting begins, in education. With the rise of laptops, tablets, and computers, some say that handwriting is a dying art. Our hands are now used to the nimble staccato rhythm of keyboard tapping, rather than the firm grip and rather more legato movement required when putting pen to paper. But not everyone feels this way. Here in the UK, at least, handwriting is still an important part of the national curriculum, especially in younger school years. Dr. Angela Webb is chair of the National Handwriting Association, and she popped by Midori House to explain why we still carry pens around in the so-called digital age.
It started many years ago, about 30 or 40 years ago, just as an interest group, with many, had professionals from different angles, concerned that this discipline might disappear. But it's morphed since then into something much more practical. So the main aims are really to promote good practice when it comes to teaching handwriting and to support people who work with children who have difficulties. So it's very much school and therapy focused with children.
I know that you do kind of outreach into schools and all the rest of it, and you actually do quite a lot of work with children. But it kind of started off as kind of a few people sitting around kind of going, this is going to die out, or people don't know how to do it well these days. And that was 40 years ago.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Just a real recognition that this was a skill to be valued. It was a skill that had to be taught. If it wasn't focused on, then it was a skill that might disappear. And it was this small group of people who felt we didn't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We had to protect this skill until we knew really how valuable it was and what the relevance it had in the current society.
That feeling 40 years ago might be
we might look back with kind of rose-tinted spectacles, thinking that everybody had nice handwriting, that maybe every child had a fountain pen in their pencil case at school. Clearly, obviously, classrooms these days, there's a lot of laptops and tablets, and there's a different way of learning. Has handwriting, have you noticed in the last maybe 5 or 10 years that handwriting has suffered due to the screens rather than the page?
Yes, I mean, I think it's quite interesting to see what happens to handwriting if it's not used exclusively. I mean, it has a large motor component. Mm. And like any motor skill, riding a bike or playing cricket, you know, if you don't perfect that skill and practice it, then you do get a bit rusty. But I think also there's a misconception about the amount of technology which most schools actually have access to. Of course, there are white electronic whiteboards and a few laptops, but most children don't have regular access to alternative technology.
We'll talk about your practice with children in schools and things in a minute, but I wanted to ask you why you care so much about it, what your passion is for handwriting, whether it's something that, you know, as you saw it dying out, or you always wanted to have beautiful handwriting and you finally achieved it. Mm-hmm. What's your personal relationship to it? Why are you in this association of handwriting?
Yes, well, many of my colleagues are interested in, they have a calligraphy background perhaps, they're very interested in the beautiful presentation of handwriting. And certainly when you look at beautiful handwriting from the last generation, it is a work of art. I came in from a different perspective because I work with children who have motor coordination difficulty. So for many of them, handwriting is a very difficult skill to master. And this was affecting their schoolwork. So my own research focused on the relationship between the physical expression of physical delivery of written text and the quality of the content that ensues. And we found this very strong relationship between the two, the physical act and the quality of composition. Handwriting can be a work of art, but it's also a functional tool. So you wouldn't ask a child to dig a hole without giving him a spade. If you want him to get his ideas down, then you need to give him the tools to do so. And handwriting is really the most fundamental tool we have, even though we have alternatives now and we're not at all Luddite. We know that this current generation will have several ways of expressing themselves on a tablet or on the page. But handwriting has a real contribution to make, which we've found growing evidence to support handwriting as conferring a benefit which other technologies can't match.
It's a strange thing because it's something that everybody sees, school children, people in offices, everybody sees people's handwriting. But unless you have properly beautiful handwriting, it's a bit like looking in your knicker drawer, isn't it? It's like it's something that's strangely public, but you don't really want anyone to look in there.
It's so personal.
Yeah, it is. It's a funny thing. Mm. A lot of people have a cagey relationship with their own handwriting. I think there's a strange idea of, well, it would be better if I wasn't in such a hurry or if I'd been taught better at school. And let's turn to schools now. It'd be nice to know to what percentage maybe handwriting is still taught in schools. I was taught handwriting with the paper with the black lines showing through so I could sort of try and sort of be vaguely tidy. Presumably that still happens. In the UK, maybe we can talk about specifically.
Yes, I mean, you're right to point out there are cultural differences around the world. Mm. Talking about the UK specifically, the last generation, a great number of young people were not taught at all. And there was a fashion when teachers were trained in the 70s not to teach it, in the idea being that you stifle creativity if you concentrated on the nuts and bolts. So there are a generation of teachers now who weren't taught. The current position is that we now know that handwriting has a value in terms of cognitive development and delivering the curriculum. So it's in the national curriculum that children should be taught.
It's that interesting thing of give children a framework and they'll fill in between those two goalposts you've made for them. That's an interesting thing. So it does, including handwriting in the curriculum, increases the cognitive framework, he said. That's a fascinating thing. It doesn't surprise me, but it's kind of nice to know that it works.
The interesting thing was when the focus was on children who had difficulty with writing, we had alternative technologies. We could teach them to touch type. And certainly that did give them a different tool which enabled them to express their ideas. But what we weren't expecting was that for children who don't have problems learning to handwrite, there is a distinct benefit over keyboarding in the physical connectivity of being able to handwrite. And it seems to stimulate creativity some way. We don't fully understand the mechanisms, but various experiments which have tested this are finding that the quality of the creativity that results from a handwritten narrative is higher than that which is keyboard delivered.
That was Dr. Angela Webb, chair of the National Handwriting Association. For a little more information on what they're doing, head to www.nha-handwriting.org.uk. Well, now we've discussed handwriting in education, it's time to put it into practice. As we know, handwriting can reveal personality traits and it doesn't always follow the same rules. Your Z might resemble the number 3. Perhaps there's a loop in your K. Maybe your capital G has a tail. Of course, this just refers to the Latin alphabet, which is the backbone of most Western languages. But what about those that use a different set of symbols, the ones that read from right to left? My producer, Holly, decided to challenge herself to a lesson in a language that she's never spoken or indeed written, Arabic. Hoping to discover the challenges of writing in a different language, she heads to the School of Oriental and African Studies in London to meet Arabic teacher Maryam Mishtawi.
Ana, Maryam. Ana. Maryam. Anna, Anti. Anna, Maryam. Anti.
Anna, Holly.
Mumtaz. Anna, Ismi, Maryam. Anti.
Anna, Ismi, Holly.
Marhaba. 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 In the Arabic language, the students struggle sometimes with some letters like the emphatic and the non-emphatic letters. For example, the difference between the letter sa and the letter so. So sa and so. You know, some students will find it difficult to find this, the difference between the letter alif, a, and a, a.
And what about in the writing of the letters? What are the main struggles there?
Again, it's because when they hear it in a wrong way, they write it in a wrong way. This is the problem. So if I'm saying, for example, her, the letter her, which is a cat, and you will write har, for example, which means hot. Okay? And again, the difference between the ha and the ha, when they write it wrong. And then it's, you know, kind of disappointing for some of the students. But they will get it because when we start, I will tell them which are the naughty letters, the letters that will cause like a bit of troubles and we need to more practice. When I'm talking about 28 letters and about two groups, we have a group of 22 letters and a group of 6 letters. On the first lesson, I always start with the non-connectors, the 6 letters, because it's easy to manage. And because they are non-connectors, when I say non-connectors, it means are selfish letters that we can never attach, especially from the front side. We only can attach them from the back side.
So is handwriting very strict in Arabic? Because I know in English, everyone writes very, very differently. Some people join, some people don't. And so with these non-connectors and connectors, I guess it's quite strict as to how you can write things.
Because if you you have to correct it to connect it when you need to connect it to looks right. Otherwise, your handwriting, the word you're writing is spelling wrong, you know, and no one will be able to read it. So you have to connect it right.
In countries where they speak Arabic, how is handwriting taught?
Writing, it's united in all the Arabic countries. So it's the one way of writing all the letters. We have the problem, not a problem, but we have different kind of spoken languages between the, for example, the Levantine and the Egyptian colloquial. But when you come to writing, we all use the same methods of writing. So we have the same alphabet and it's united in all the Arabic countries.
And you're from Lebanon?
Yes.
Originally. Do you find the way that you think about how to write French and English letters very different to how you think about how to write Arabic letters?
Yes, of course. You know, what I try to do is I try to make it easy for the student by, like, as you see, for example, say that the it looks like a river, for example. There are a group of letters that they look like a fish. I call them fish letters, so they have this, you know, the same like drawing like a fish. You know, I try to associate it with pictures or with words that they already, you know, they're familiar with. So here we're going to go now, and I want you to write for me.
Okay, pen in my hand.
Okay, I'm going to go slowly and pronounce it slowly for you. Dar. What's the first letter you can hear?
So the first letter is the D, which is the 35 degree angle one.
Very good, excellent. But keep
so base on the line.
You always
and then
start from top.
Start from the top.
Yeah.
Okay.
Excellent. Here we go. So the sound after it is ah, dar.
That's the long A sound, and very it's a long good line because it's the line very from the good top to the bottom of your mouth.
Excellent. Bravo, Holly. So the last sound is
So that's the river.
Excellent. And the sliding start, letter.
And that goes under the line.
Excellent. See? So this is your first word.
And what does da mean?
House.
Okay, my first Arabic word is house. And Arabic writing is very beautiful to look at. What's your favorite letter? Is that to say?
It's like the French R. And I like it, especially in the middle when I color it. I feel like it's so artistic. And like I like the pronunciation of it too.
That was Mariam Mishtawi giving Holly Fisher a lesson in Arabic. To find out more about SOAS's language lessons, head to soas.ac.uk/language-centre. After the break, we'll be heading to India to meet one of the last Urdu calligraphers in the world. Stay tuned.
Indigo and lavender are the ingredients for success for two entrepreneurs based in Wales. We travel through Valley and Dale to meet a jeans maker and a lavender farmer getting it right.
It turned out, you know, everybody loved to come and actually see lavender oil being distilled right here in Wales. So somehow there's a holistic thing going on here that's about the lavender, about distilling, and about a way of life in these hills.
Made in Wales, now playing in the films menu at monocle.com.
This is Culture with me, Robert Bound, and this week we're talking all about handwriting. In India, the language of Urdu was once the lingua franca of the capital, Delhi. Even after it was chosen to become the official language of Pakistan, many speakers in India remained proud of its heritage. While the language sounds similar to Hindi, its script is similar to Arabic, a form called Nastaliq. It's a beautiful script when handwritten, as it should be, flowy and ornate, with a rounded form. However, when it was time for the script to be computerised, programmers opted to use a stodgier, squarer form known as NASC on computers and devices, and this is fast taking hold. As a result, there are fears that the beautiful Urdu script is dying out. But one school in Delhi is trying to change all that. Monocle's Aarti Betigeri visited to see just what they're doing to change things.
Here in Old Delhi, the city's ancient walled quarter, there are just a few trained Urdu calligraphers left, when there were once thousands. Practitioners sometimes go days without getting any work, whether it be handwriting documents or lettering lines from the Quran. The Urdu Academy is housed in a well-preserved, whitewashed building, bearing all the hallmarks of the British Raj: columns, wide shaded balconies and a large garden. It's an incongruous place for an organisation that's intent on preserving the language and customs of the culture that the British deposed when they came to India. But here in the calligraphy class, no one's complaining. Wasim Ahmed teaches calligraphy at the Urdu Academy. He says he has around 50 students at the moment, all of whom feel that learning to properly write the script is vital to preserving the city's ancient culture.
When a man sits down and writes this language, his heart feels the language, and any onlooker would see the same beauty in it. So he would find passion in it and would find the urge to write more and more of it.
Even though it's not widely handwritten anymore, Ahmed isn't worried about the script dying out.
ये कोई मरता नहीं जब तक उर्दू जिंदा है तो ये भी जिंदा रहेगी उर्दू इसके बगैर अधूरी है
He doesn't agree with that calligraphy is a dying art. He told me that until Urdu is alive, the language, this art cannot die until then.
इसको सीखना चाहते हैं
More and more students are enrolling each year in this course of calligraphy here in this institute, and there are so many mosques and buildings where they invite his students to come and write on the walls. So for him, this is not a dying art, and it can never be. The Delhi government has also provided them this institute and the infrastructure to work on it, to let it exist. He believes that it is the future.
His students range from jeans-clad city boys to housewives to traditional bearded young men in training to become Muslim priests. One is Haider Anas, who is a student in Arabic studies at Delhi University.
This is qalam. In English, it is called pen, and it is of wooden pen. And we need to, first of all, we need to sharp it clearly. If it is not in good condition, then we cannot able to write good handwriting. First, we need to sharp it very clearly. It is the right sense to hold this qalam is, you can put your mid finger on this near in front of the maidan, and then put it and continue it. And if it is not blurring, you can say, then it is in good condition. Like this is not blurring. And this is all called mashq. If it is in good condition, then we teach another lesson from our teacher.
Why did you want to learn this handwriting?
Because of this is our culture, and one of the best and oldest form of languages, which came from Iran.
This is how you write the first letter, alifa.
Alif.
The first letter, A, it's alif.
As I get up to lead, Ahmed calls me back and asks me to join his next calligraphy class. He might not be worried about the death of the Urdu script, but still he'd like as many people as possible to carry the art form down the line. For Monocle in Old Delhi, I'm Aarti Beshagiri.
Thank you, Aarti. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. Next week, art critic Sarah Thornton will be dropping by to tell us about her new book, 33 Artists in Three Acts. And there's music from British musician Rue Paynes too. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounder. My producer was Holly Fisher, she who dots the T's and crosses the I's, like the minx that she is. Time for one final song this week from Sarah Jane Morris. This is No Beyoncé. Thanks for tuning in.
She saw her sister killed by her father, encouraged and abetted by her mother. Why did no one believe her when she spoke? Did they really think that this was some sick joke? Why did she revert to denial and silence? Kept close the image of fatal family violence. And now she can't tell between a truth and a lie, but it haunts her still. Why did her sister have to die? No Beyoncé, no Shakira for you, no fashion, no boyfriends too. You will do just what we tell you to do. To our thinking you will be true. Oh, the whore you became when you bought Western shame on this good family name. She saw her sister killed by her father, encouraged and abetted by her mother, because her parents wanted their daughter to stay confined in a village 1,000 miles away. Why couldn't she just have upped and fled away from the demons playing in her head? Now she stands hollow and frozen instead on the ground where her sister lies dead. No Beyoncé, no Shakira for you, no fashion, no boyfriends too. You will do just what we tell you to do. To our thinking you will be true. Oh, the whore you became when you bought Western shame on this good family name. Yes, the whore you became when you bought Western shame on this good family name. No Shakira for you, no fashion, no boyfriends too. You will do just what we tell you to do. To our thinking you will be true. Oh, the whore you became when you bought Western shame on this good family name.
Yes, the whore you became when you bought Western shame on this good family name. No Beyonce, no Beyonce, no Shakira for you. No fashion, no fashion, no boyfriends too. We will crush your will, sure as blood will spill. For honor we will kill, for honor we will kill. We will crush your will, sure as blood will spill. For honor we will kill, for honor we will kill. No Beyonce, no Beyonce, no Shakira for you. No fashion, no fashion, no boyfriends too. We will crush your will, sure as blood will spill. For honor we will kill, for honor we will kill. We will crush your will, sure as blood will spill. For honor we will kill.